Hello, everybody. Welcome to this session. My name is Christopher Coker. I'm director of LSE Ideas, which is the foreign policy think tank of the London School of Economics. And today we're discussing a very timely theme, nationalism and world order in an era of populism, which is a very large, expansive subject. But we're going to focus in on it by looking at the work of E.H. Carr, an essay he wrote many years ago called Nationalism and After. And we're going to ask whether what he had to say about nationalism then was right, and whether what he had to say then applies today. E.H. Carr was a historian, amongst other things, as well as I suppose we call him a political scientist, because he was professor of international relations. But he was not, as Richard Evans likes to tell us, a professional historian. He didn't have a degree in history. He never taught in a history department. He spent 20 years in the Foreign Office, during which time he wrote a book on Dostoevsky, which makes him a little unusual. And then he became professor of international relations for the first time in 1936 and ended his life as a senior research fellow in Cambridge when he died in 1982, aged 90. I had rooms in the same building as him at Trinity College, Cambridge, and I would often come across him wandering the corridors. I can assure you he was not student friendly, but perhaps that was just me. His most famous book is The History of Soviet Russia. It's about 19 volumes. It probably goes largely unread these days, but he's famous for two particular works. So one that I've already alluded to indirectly, What is History? Lectures that he gave in the early 1960s, which are still required reading for historians, but also, and this is why we're here today, an essay on nationalism, to which my esteemed colleague Michael Cox has written a lengthy preface and extended essay, which he will be talking to today. Mick is founding director of LSE Ideas. He's an eminent Cold War historian, and he's also a leading historian of ideas. And our two other panelists are equally distinguished, John Brey, who's professor of ethnicity and nationalism at also the LSE, a leading historian of 19th century European history, who's written, amongst others, a seminal work on nationalism and the state. And finally, Mary Caldor, who's director of Conflict and Civil Society Research Unit, also at LSE, the author of many books, but most recent, I think, is Global Security Cultures. So all of these panelists are eminently qualified to discuss and debate the contribution of E.H. Carr to nationalism, to an understanding of nationalism, but they will obviously widen their scope and refer to any of the questions that you might like to pose about nationalism and its place today. Please post up those questions in the Q&A section, and I will field the questions at the end. I just say, by way of introduction, that Terry Eagleton said of religion, he asked the question, why has God survived into a supposedly faithless age? He was, of course, referring to Western Europe very largely. And one of the reasons, he says, is that atheism is not as easy as it looks. So why has nationalism still such a strong purchase on our imagination? Because I think the alternatives like cosmopolitanism or Europeanism in the context of the EU, it's not as easy as it looks. And that's why populism and nationalism has come back, just as Christian fundamentalists in the United States are such a prominent part of the American political landscape, because the appeal of religion is still extremely strong. But Mick, anyway, enough of these introductory comments and observations. Over to you.
Well, thank you, Christopher. First of all, thanks to John Broiley, who was in the government department for many years. And if I might say so, John took forward what I've always considered to be one of the many great LSE traditions of the study of nationalism and ethnicity within the government department. I certainly hope that the LSE takes the issue of nationalism seriously. It needs to and should. But congratulations to you and all your colleagues, because it does build on a great tradition at the LSE through yourself and through others who we'll talk about later on, including the very great Ernest Gellner, who we will mention as well. A second thanks goes to my old friend, Mary Caldor. I heard the word cosmopolitan just used then by Christopher. My immediate thought was that describes Mary Caldor rather well, and I don't think you would take that as being an insult, Mary, but it's great to see you. We've worked together before on many issues. We held a conference on peace movements many, many years back, and it's really good to see you down there in Brighton. But anyway, and finally, thanks to Christopher for that wonderful, very, if I might say so, Kokorista introduction, full of erudition and challenging at the same time, Christopher. And congratulations on all the great work you've been doing, taking ideas forward. Now, the title of what we're going to be discussing today is, as Christopher mentions, you know, very, very, very broad: nationalism, world order in the era of populism. And in part, this is to debate nationalism, the nation state, the viability of one, the nation state, and indeed whether or not there is an alternative to the nation state, or whether or not and why nationalism still remains such a persistent force in world politics in the 21st century. The book which was mentioned, and I'll only briefly bring it up on the screen now, is this one here, if you don't mind me doing it. It's with my name at the bottom there. It's called Nationalism and After. It was published in 1945, just as the Second World War was coming to an end. It was written by Edward Hallett Carr, who was then the Woodrow Wilson Professor in the Department of International Politics at Aberystwyth. And it was part of a problem, a challenge that Carr was dealing with at the time. Now, I would say straight away that he wasn't the only person thinking and dealing with and trying to come to terms with nationalism at the end of the Second World War or throughout the whole interwar period. He doesn't stand alone as both a writer on nationalism and a critic of the phenomenon as well. There was a vast literature in that whole period, which John knows very, very well indeed, which dealt with nationalism, both trying to understand it, where did it come from? Could you build an international order on the basis of nationalism? And of course, coming out of the Second World War, it's not surprising, if you think about it for the moment, that there was a highly critical attitude towards nationalism, because nationalism was very much associated not with something we today would call populism, but which we called then fascism and Nazism, which was all highly nationalistic creeds. And of course, the argument was, of course, that nationalism not alone, but nationalism became an ideology of aggression, an ideology of racism almost, and that therefore it's not surprising that someone like Carr, given his own left-wing background, his own views on the world by then, would become very critical of it. So what I've done in the introduction, and I won't talk too much about that, but I will in a moment, simply explain how he arrived at the views that he did on nationalism, which in itself is an interesting story, not just about Carr, but about the history of the late 20th century, particularly following the Versailles Peace Treaty of 1919. Carr was also involved, just to kind of just bring Carr back in just for the moment, and can't avoid him in this debate. He was also very much involved with Chatham House, the Royal Institute of International Affairs, throughout the 1930s, and indeed after and during and after the Second World War. And he actually chaired a three-year study group within Chatham House, which went from 36 to 39, and he basically put together this committee, which then came out with a book, rather uninspiring title, I have to say, called Nationalism, in which he kind of looks at the origins of the nation state. Where did it come from? Was it ancient? Was it modern? And he tried to kind of analyze where this phenomenon had come to. And of course, he was asked to do this by Chatham House at a time when nationalism was in the ascendancy. So to understand the book, if I can put it bluntly, the 45 book, you've got to put it in the context of the world crisis of the interwar period. It does make sense outside of that. I think it does have some general points to make, which I think are not unimportant about, does the nation state constitute the basis of order? Can we move beyond the nation state? Is nationalism an ideology which is going to promote human progress, or is it one that's going to restrain it? And of course, there are different views about nationalism. Some would say that some nationalisms are progressive and that some nationalisms are reactive. So there's no one single phenomenon we would call nationalism. And maybe that's something we will take up both in the Q&A and what John and Mary will take up. It's a very modern question we've asked about populism today. But if you look back as John well knows, and Mary too, through her own work, it's a very, very old problem. Where did the nation state come from? I mean, I can't tell you how many books I've read on this kind of the genealogy of the nation. What was a nation? We are told in the first sentence, we all live in groups. And one of those groups ultimately becomes the unit we call the nation state. Of course, though, in history, in historical terms, the most important unit that most people tended to live in was either the family, the village, or in a larger context, within empires, not so much inside nation states. And I think that's quite important. In some senses, the nation state is a rather modern phenomenon. How far back should we look for the origins of the nation state? Some would even argue, and you can read some good material on this, that in essence, the English were the originators of nationalism in their great struggles against France throughout the 14th and 15th century. And that Shakespeare becomes the great English poet of the nation state. There are others who, of course, would argue that the origins of the nation state and modern nationalism, to make that distinction between nationalism and old and new, if that is a useful distinction, it comes with the French Revolution and the attachment of the revolution with the national ideal. But even that doesn't begin to take us halfway there. Throughout the 19th century, you get the emergence of new nation states, whether Italy, whether Germany, the rise of nationalist consciousness. Many years ago, when I was visiting Norway, I learned that the whole language issue with inside Norway was bound up with the question of a rediscovery of what was called landmål, the traditional Norwegian language, which had been overridden by both Danish and Swedish. Carr's intersection and interest in nationalism, however, begins, and Christopher mentioned this, it begins really when he's working in the Foreign Office. He joins the Foreign Office in 1916. He does what most young junior clerks in the Foreign Office do. He writes memos. But of course, then comes the end of the First World War. Then comes the Paris peace negotiations. And without going into too much detail, basically the young Carr, and he was very young at this stage, the young Carr is asked to go over to Paris and work with the new states, the creation of the new states. The collapse of the old empires was bringing about the creation of new states, obviously. Now, within those new states, there were, and this is one of the real issues about why Carr was so critical of nationalism, there were very large minorities. In a sense, as the Austro-Hungarian Empire collapsed, as the Russian Empire withdraws and collapses, only to be reconstituted by the Bolsheviks, as Germany partially collapses, at that point, you create these new nations, and these were supported by the great powers, the British, the French, and of course, obviously, Woodrow Wilson, whose slogan of the right of self-determination was one which gave great support to the creation of these new states, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Yugoslavia, and others as well. Some of the smaller states of Central Europe, of course, did very, very badly in this process, especially, most obviously, Hungary. Some other states did extremely well, namely Romania, who took over most of what was then Transylvania. But Carr was thrust into this position of saying, well, how do we deal with creating viable new nation states, yet at the same time reconcile that with minority rights? And so he literally sat for a year and a half, trying to work with the various nationalists of the time, Polish, or Romanian, or Czechoslovak, or Yugoslav, trying to work out what to do. And it was a long, and I think for him, a very rather bitter experience. Because I think he came out of that, and this in a sense is the beginning of his thinking about the nation state and nationalism and why he's so critical of both. He comes out of that really thinking that nationalism is not a foundation for order, particularly in Central Europe. And in some senses, I think that was proven to be right. Now, this is not to deny the right of self-determination for any peoples, but it's one thing, and I think Carr became a huge critic of the notion of an absolute right of self-determination on the grounds that it was very, very fine liberal principle as enunciated by Woodrow Wilson, but whether it laid the foundation for any degree of order in Central Europe or was economically rational in terms of bringing prosperity to that whole region, that was another question. So that's the first part of the story. The second part of the story really runs through the 1930s as Carr begins to think about a new international order and how to construct a new international order. And he brings out a series of books. He's already arrived in 1936, as Christopher mentioned, to take up the Woodrow Wilson professorship. He writes 7 books altogether while he's at Aberystwyth between 1936 and 1947. The 3 most important by far, one the most famous, which we use in international relations all the time now, and to which I've also written an introduction, seems to be my role in life, writing introductions for E.H. Carr, was the 20 Years' Crisis, which was published in 1939. In 1942, he brings out another book, a very popular book at the time, although again, very much unread today, called Conditions of Peace. And in 1945, he then brings out the book I showed on the screen earlier on, Nationalism and After. And in that, what he's really trying to do is 2 or 3 things. One is work out what the origins of the crisis is, which has brought us from the high hopes of Versailles in 1919 to the beginning of a new world war in 1939. What causes this crisis? Now, he doesn't say it's all down to nationalism. He obviously recognizes the crisis of capitalism in the interwar period, the rise of fascism in Italy, Nazism in Germany. That can't all be ascribed to an ideology called nationalism. However, the way in which the world is going in the interwar period is towards disintegration, not towards integration. It's moving away from what we might now today call globalization towards national autarky, towards national self-sufficiency, and then ultimately war. And he sees this really as something that, to which one has to find a practical answer. Otherwise, after the next war, the Second World War, when it finally comes in 39, we're going to be back in the same place. So he's very much a problem-solving writer on this as well. His answer, to be perfectly honest, is one that I think is quite challenging and not one that everybody has accepted. I know a number of writers, Christopher, who are great admirers of Carr on the 20 Years' Crisis, particularly his emphasis on power, competition, his hard-nosed realism. Many American realist friends of mine, and I have quite a few, I think, you know, regard Carr really as a wonderful writer, but they think that his writing on nationalism kind of loses the plot almost. Because what he's proposing, or seems to be proposing, is a new international order, an order that begins to transcend the nation state and move beyond nationalism itself. So one of his admirers, I won't mention his name, he's an old friend of mine, said that one of Carr's worst books, and you mentioned the Soviet history, which hardly anybody reads today, Christopher, that he actually says he thinks it's one of his worst books is Nationalism and After, because he simply got nationalism wrong. Far from the nation state disappearing or nationalism withering away, nation states actually became more prolific after World War II, and nationalism, of course, got a new head of steam in what we later came to call the Third World. So it's a very contentious book. You could almost call it a very utopian book in some ways. And this is one of the reasons, a challenging critical book as well, which is one of the reasons why many of his realist admirers, who admire him for all sorts of other things, have never been quite persuaded of his views, either on the nation state and nationalism. What does he actually say about the nation state? He certainly recognizes the depth of feeling that creates nations. He's not unaware of that. You know, the notions of loyalty, identity, he realizes this is a very powerful force in history. And indeed, when he worked with Chatham House between 36 and 39, he comes back to this time and again. How is it that this particular phenomenon simply won't go away? Because it won't. He's well aware, therefore, of the depth of it. He's also well aware that, at least for 400 to 500 years, it's been the unit of international society, international system, namely the nation state. His response to that is to say, okay, I hear that, I know that, I understand it, but here are my 3 points. One, the world is in the peoples in the world, humanity in its widest sense, has not always been organized into nation states. In fact, if you go back, 400 or 500 years before the beginnings of the origins of the nation state in Europe in particular, it was actually organized in imperial terms, not in nations. There is nothing natural, quote unquote, about the nation state. I think that is his I think that is his first point, one which I think we can take up. Secondly, he thinks the costs of having nation states, and certainly the costs of nationalism, outweigh any benefits they may ever accumulate. And he's again writing in 1945, at the end of a long war, at the end of a long 20 years crisis. In other words, he's saying, well, okay, I know it's, you know, it may be utopian to try and think forward to a new international order, but nonetheless, what have we just been through since 1919? You know, total disintegration in Central Europe, you know, another world depression and another Second World War. And therefore we've got to move beyond where we are in order to find a realistic solution to this particular and fundamental problem of our age. I think he also thought that the world was moving in a certain direction of large units. There's something what I call rather largest about Carr. He kind of thinks, it's a Marxist way of thinking possibly, that it, in essence, the future does not lie with small states or a proliferation of even more states. All that's going to do is proliferate the problems of disorder in the world, not of order in the world. And I think he therefore starts to think through the idea that in a sense, the future, whether this is a correct prediction or not, I'll leave up to John and Mary to pick up, that the future actually lay with large units. In fact, for somebody who was quite critical of the United States in the Cold War, he actually thought of the United States as a very good large unit in the international system, you know, because it would act like a large unit. There was something, I suppose, quite imperial about Carr in that regard. The other part of the other side of that equation, Christopher, and you mentioned his work on the Soviet Union, I think he therefore saw the Soviet Union through that light as well. It wasn't just that he was a socialist, he believed in planning and all the rest of it, and all that is true, of course, and he did believe the Soviet Union was an experiment we had to understand, not attack, but I think he also thought that the Soviet Union would be a solution to the national question, both within what was the old imperial Russia, but also in Eastern Europe as well. And there's no doubt that, you know, if you were Polish or a Czech, you would have real problems with Carr, because in a sense, he's looking at this in a very large scale, large way of thinking, that the way to resolve all these nationalisms, which have caused so much difficulty and which have not addressed their own minorities problem, is to have a progressive social political organization such as the USSR. And of course, that's opened him up quite rightly too, to the criticism that in his attempt to critique the right of self-determination, he denies the freedom for peoples. You know, and that, of course, is one thing that, you know, that been hung around his neck, probably quite legitimately so, for many years to come. Take two or three other points before I hand it over to John. I still think, however, and I'd be as critical of Carr on many things, as even though I've done so much work on him, there are things to criticise about Carr. Don't get me wrong. I think there are all sorts of questions to it. But I think he poses a problem we can't avoid. How do you create order on the basis of a multiplication and multiplicity of nation states? I mean, nationalism may have a progressive side, and I've heard people argue that, that everybody has a right of self-determination. I've heard people argue that as well, perfectly so. But when you actually see the practical workings out of this particular doctrine, these particular ideas, are the outcomes always benign? And the answer Carr will put forward is they are not. They are not always benign. I mean, look, Mary knows a great deal about former Yugoslavia, where she was very much involved, I know, in the 1990s. Well, were the consequences of nationalism, extreme nationalism in former Yugoslavia benign? Have all the consequences of nationalism in former Soviet Union been benign? Well, some I would support, no question about it. But we've got to be realistic and look it hard in the face and say, is this the only solution to the question? We don't know. But I think that is an important question we nonetheless have to argue. The other thing is that we do confront not only nationalism elsewhere, to use a phrase, but we also confront it at home. And I think one of the great problems of our day, and I'm only saying something which I don't think is terribly original, but it's certainly one of the great problems of our day, that nationalism is on the rise. I mean, we call it populism, we can call it all sorts of other things, but you know, we've seen now a series of populist movements. We saw it in Brexit, we certainly saw it in Trump. We've seen it around the world in other parts of the world, such as India, or in Turkey, or even indeed in China, although they wouldn't call it populism in China, we've seen a kind of sense of utilizing nationalism as a means of mobilization of your populations, and therefore constructing others as your enemy. And I think that, again, is hugely dangerous, not only in terms of humanity and in terms of how humans relate to each other, because the consequence of relating to each other in a particularly antagonistic way can be deadly and dangerous and can lead to all sorts of appalling human consequences. But it also is going to create the conditions over the long term. So I think, again, one of the reasons I find Carr interesting on this, and I'd say not in an uncritical fashion, that he does ask questions about our modern world as well. That if we are moving in a direction which is taking us away from a more cosmopolitan period, if we are moving in a direction in which nationalism is on the rise, and we could debate that, and if we are moving in a direction that is taking us away from cooperation towards conflict, then we have to consider how we can move beyond that and not just simply accept it. I'd say one final point, of course, because this may be a very British point, of course, a whole debate about the European Union. One of the interesting larger units, by the way, that Carr was very enthusiastic about, and it wasn't just the Soviet Union, was what we would now call the European Union. In the Conditions of Peace, he's got actually a fantastically good chapter, by the way, on the future of Europe. And he sees the future of Europe through cooperation, not through maintaining the nation state in the traditional form it had assumed in the interwar period. He calls upon France and Germany and the smaller countries around them to cooperate, to create functional cooperation, very much like David Mitrani was proposing at the time as well. So although it's very easy to criticize Carr on the Soviet Union and even on how he viewed the Soviet relationship with Eastern Europe, and I understand how he arrived at that, whether you agree with it, it's another question. One also has to look, he was a very forward-looking thinker when it came to the Europe and the European Union as well. So with that, those general comments, Christopher, I hope that opens up for a debate and a discussion. I hope I didn't run over my time. And I'll hand over to John now. Thank you very much, Christopher.
Thank you very much, Mick. Mary told me that you could only see my eyes. I hope you can see more than my eyes now. But I suppose the eyes are windows into the soul, so they're the best part. Thank you very much. Mick, you will have a chance to respond to John and Mary's points when we get to the Q&A. So feel free to do that. John, can we go straight to you, please?
Okay, I hope you can hear me.
Yeah? Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you for the invitation. The way I'm going to do this is I want to talk about Carr's understanding of nationalism, but Mick has said a lot about that and Mick knows a lot more about it than I do. But I want to look at it in the light of the subsequent development of a field of studies called nationalism studies, which really I think took off in the 1980s. And in particular, I want it to relate to the work of Ernest Gellner, who, in my opinion, has produced the most powerful single theoretical approach to the subject of nationalism, and particularly a year after Carr's death, a book he published in 1983, Nations and Nationalism. But furthermore, subsequently, quite a good deal later, Gellner published an essay on nationalism and after. So we actually have Gellner's own direct appreciation of Carr's work. And a very interesting thing, Gellner has a very mordant sense of humour, very funny sometimes. You laugh out loud at some of the things he says. And he says that he read Carr when he was studying PPE, Politics, Philosophy and Economics at Oxford, just towards the end of the war. And the thing that struck him there was that there was nothing significant about politics. Philosophy was unworldly in one kind of a way, and economics was unworldly in another kind of a way. And he read Carr, and Carr lived in the real world. And he really appreciated that. But he then pretty much forgot Carr and didn't come back to him for about another 40 years. First of all, he has critical remarks to make about Carr, and some of these I share and some of them I don't. First of all, and it picks up on a point that Mick made, is Carr's periodization of nationalism. He basically has four periods. The first period is the period up to the French Revolution, what he calls the breakdown of the medieval unity, referred to the imperial character of medieval Europe. The second is the period from the French Revolution, when, in a sense, the radical democratic concept of the nation enters history. But then through the 19th century, it doesn't have apparently very destructive consequences after the demise of Napoleon, because of British hegemony, free trade, gold standard, and so on. And then the period which really, I think, interests him above all is period three, that is beginning really with the era of the two world wars, although he does say something about the anticipation of that in the latter end of the 19th century, particularly with German unification. And then finally, he has a period four, which is the bit that the nationalism and after refers to. Now, I agree entirely with Gellner that it is quite wrong to call the first period a period of the nation state. When you look at it, apart from France and Britain, you can't really talk about national states, except for the one he doesn't mention, which is but very much towards the very end of it, the United States of America before the French Revolution. Most of Europe and most of the world is still organised in imperial units or very small-scale sub-national units. What he's really talking about, I would say, is the rise of the territorial sovereign state. And he's particularly talking about what the one person has called the founding myth of international relations, the notion of the Westphalian Treaty giving rise to this idea of a plurality of sovereign states. But these sovereign states are dynastic powers. They are not nation states. The nation does not in any way get involved. And most of these sovereigns do not think of themselves in national terms. They think of themselves in Christian terms, and they think in terms of dynastic glory and honour. In a way, Carr makes the point that this does, to some extent, tame international relations, because this ethos, which produces wars, war of dynastic successions, for example, but this ethos also constrains the way in which war is fought and constrains the conduct of international relations, because these people, in a sense, they're cosmopolitan in a way. They understand each other, they have the same values, and so on. His second period is the period of from the French Revolution, when essentially like the nation is invited into history. But the point is there, but after 1815, we have this, to some extent, looks an almost ideal situation where British hegemony, exercised very discreetly through the gold standard, through free trade, through international economic arrangements, and not accidentally through the dominance of the British Navy over every other naval force in the world. This actually leads to a period of relative peace, but it's also a period where nation state still isn't an especially widespread phenomenon. Most of East Central Europe and Southern Europe are not organised in nation states, and even when there are such national states, such as Spain, they're hardly liberal. So we're again talking about, if we're talking about the nation state, we're really basically projecting from a very small part of Western Europe and the USA by now onto the rest of the world. So the key really is period three. This is what really matters, I think, to Carr and students of nationalism. Period three sees the undermining of British hegemony. This begins already in the late 19th century, and it begins particularly with German unification. Germany suddenly is a new powerful force on the block, challenging the existing powerful states, and not agreeing with many of the ways in which the present order is arranged. For example, free trade arrangements, introducing economic protectionism, seeking to find its own colonies as it feels it's been left out, and so on. And this beginning of the unravelling of this era of the British hegemony comes to a climax with the two world wars. Period three for Carr also sees the economic development which produces the entry of the masses into politics. States now are based on popular participation. This compels states to give priority to domestic popular economic interests. This basically undermines the notion of international free trade and liberal constitutionalism. the nation state now, and increasingly we can talk about the nation state, must align itself with national popular interests. Nationalism and nation state come together. This convergence produces illiberal nationalism, and this climaxes with the world wars. And the outcome, particularly strongly with the outcome of the Versailles Treaty of 1919, is an international order of many sovereign states, many of them small, many of them lacking in power, but nevertheless very concerned to assert themselves, and the dominance, therefore, of nationalism. And this, of course, leads to these two massive destructive wars. And therefore, the question is, how do we stop this happening again? I mean, how were we so unable to construct anything after the First World War, such that within 20 years, there was a second and even greater world war? Now, this is where Gellner, I bring Gellner in. There were two key differences in Gellner's approach to these subjects than Carr's. One is conceptual and the other is geographical. The conceptual is that Gellner asks the question specifically, why is the group that is so important, the nation, a cultural group, possibly seen in terms of language or history or whatever? Why is that the case? It seems to me Carr doesn't actually pose that question. Carr simply assumes that once the masses enter history within the context of a territorial state, they in a sense will become nationalist. And to some extent, the emotionality and mass irrationality will start to affect politics. Gellner wants a much more specific answer to this question. And he finds it, and I won't begin to try and go into it because it's a I think basically he is one of these one idea man, but one idea pursued brilliantly and across a wide range of disciplines. It's about the nature of modernity. The masses enter history through industrialism. His focus is not on democracy, but on industrialism. And industrialism requires standardized mass cultures. Literacy, for example, is crucial. That requires a standard language. And it is attachment to that national culture which is the key to understanding nationalism. These cultures become the bearers of nationality and nationalism, at least in the existing nation states. Carr, it seems to me, jumps from mass politics to nationalism without exploring this specific cultural dimension. It's not a criticism because I think Gellner's book is an almost absolutely original book. The one really original text, and Carr does refer to it, is Otto Bauer and Karl Renner on nationality in the Habsburg Empire. That's a different matter. But Gellner also moves from Western to East Central Europe. In fact, I would argue that Gellner has two theories of nationalism and two kinds of nationalism. The first is the one based on the popular nationalism with the standardized cultures of industrial Western European nation states and the USA. But the second is the elite nationalism of the backward multinational states of East Central and Southern Europe. Now, Carr also knows that the nationalism in East Central Europe is absolutely crucial. We know, for example, this is where geographically both world wars originate. The assassination of Franz Ferdinand by a Serb nationalist in 1914, and the disputes between Germany and its new successor state neighbours, Czechoslovakia, Poland and the like, in East Central Europe. But it seems to me he cannot explain nationalism, and neither can Gellner, in terms of industrial society and democratic politics. These are not mass political systems. They are not democratic. They are highly authoritarian. And certainly before the world wars, they don't involve mass involvement. In fact, there's a new branch of studies in nationalism studies called national indifference, which is exploring just how little people in this part of the world thought in terms of nationality. Now, Gellner sees it, this nationalism, as a reaction to the first kind of nationalism. It's a resentment by elites of precisely the advanced, more advanced economies. So we already have two big differences, and we have two different kinds of nationalism now complicating the matter. Another thing I would suggest, and this is a criticism of both Carr and Gellner, they don't actually consider the causal role of war itself, particularly the First and Second World Wars. There's something unique about those wars, which is the convergence of mass participation, conscription, mass armies, which really became significant from Napoleon onwards, with new technologies, new destructive technologies. One thinks, for example, of aerial power, but also communications, the industrialization of warfare. Before mid-19th century, this technology was lacking. After 1945, the technology made mass participation increasingly less important. Nuclear deterrent, nuclear weapons, intercontinental missiles and the like, the desire of the military to be more professional than a mass conscript army. And it seems to me that in many ways, the masses enter history, for example, in parts of East Central Europe, say in Serbia, through mass participation in the wars. So that's a factor that could be an independent factor in explaining nationalism, particularly in these areas with elite nationalism. Again, I think Gellner and Carr largely agree on the post-1945 period. The factors destabilizing the international order in Carr's period three were, to sum it up very simply, three factors: too many sovereign states, many of them small and not very powerful, economic inequality and resentment, and nationalism. Now we have the rival multilateral alliances dominated by the USA and the Soviet Union, plus economic growth, which moderates nationalism. And Gellner goes on to argue that providing that continues, nationalism will continue to exist, but it won't exist as a destructive force because it won't be placed within this anarchic multi-state system or deep economic resentment. However, these factors, and Mick makes it clear in his introduction, seem to return with the end of the Cold War. There's also a specific issue that I want to mention that Mick writes about but didn't mention in his remarks, which is the problem of shifting relationships of powerful states to one another. That just as Carr was addressing the question of Germany, how did you accommodate Germany's rise again after the First World War? How do you accommodate, for example, the rise of China within the present international order? How do you accommodate it peacefully, at least? Leaving aside, obviously, there's huge differences between Carr's period three and the present, let's call it period five. But just to focus on these three factors, how do we understand them and their combination? Because again, I think there's a question of just how these three factors are understood in Carr's work or anybody's work. Is the real problem a multipolar system of sovereign states with unequal amounts of power? In a way, to come back to Carr in Versailles, it seems to me it was impossible to avoid the multiplication of states. The Central Powers would be defeated, the Ottoman Empire, the Habsburg Empire were finished. For some time, it looked as though the Romanov Empire might also be finished. Clearly, the major powers on the winning side were not going directly to extend their rule into those areas. So clearly there had to be some alternative system, and it's difficult to see what it could have been except a system of smaller successor states. Does it matter whether these states are nation states? Is nationalism a cause for these states to exist, or is it a way of legitimizing states that were going to be produced in any case? Take Wilson's doctrine of national self-determination. It's very interesting. The text in which he first mentions that appears the day after he is given a translation of a speech by Trotsky, in which the Bolsheviks have declared the principle of national self-determination. In many ways, Wilson was almost forced into this policy by the fear that it was going to be the Bolsheviks who came to dominate the success of the post-First World War European map. He used the term national self-determination, and his Secretary of State, Robert Lansing, was appalled that he used it. But actually, he didn't use it for a long time after then. He started using other terms like with the consent of the people and so on. But in the end, we were going to have a Poland, we were going to have a Czech or a Slovak, we were going to have something like what we got. Could we then have avoided having nationalism with it at all? Would nationalism really actually be the factor that made this an unstable system? Well, I think it would, because, for example, if you look at Poland, which Mick points out, you know, increasingly the HCR came to detest the Polish nationalists, their resentment, their thin-skinnedness, their refusal to address realistically the problem of 30% non-ethnic Poles in their country was going to make all kinds of problems for them. But, and the third, the second factor is nationalism. The third factor is economic inequality. It's interesting that Carr really starts to write about these issues, not in the 1920s, but with the onset of the Great Depression. It's in the 1930s. In other words, these issues on their own are not enough to be destructive. What is destructive is the economic resentments and inequalities that are produced. Now, it seems to me where Gellner talked about Carr living in the real world is the way Carr so concisely and lucidly addresses these problems and the kinds of ideas Mick mentioned, some of them, for example, functional cooperation between European states, alliance between the USA, the Soviet Union, and Great Britain. Great Britain having to come to terms with its decline as a major power, the USA having to come to terms with the rise of the Soviet Union as a major power. If one had what Carr then suggested, economic planning and a focus on social justice, above all full employment, this actually would also address the issue of resentment. It would, the functional units would address the issue of international anarchy. There would still be many states, but they would only be sovereign in a much more moderate, diluted form than the kind of sovereignty autonomy they enjoyed in the interwar period. And aggressive nationalism, if, as Carr's analysis implies, this is mainly a function of economic inequality and resentment, then multilateral economic planning might reduce its significance. However, and this is where Gellner comes back in again, if one thought that there were independent cultural and social factors which explained nationalism, concerned with prestige and status, independent of political power or economic standing, then this would not be enough. And in fact, it's interesting that some of the current debates between political scientists about populism is to what extent populism is rooted in economic problems, or to what extent there are quite independent cultural factors. One thinks, for example, of white nationalism in the United States of America, of the way in which Brexit could cultivate the resentment of immigrants. People would argue, I think, that these were fairly irrational concerns. They had very little to do with any objective economic interests. So that, again, if one adds Gellner's cultural understanding to Carr's political understanding of nationalism, then the problems can become much more difficult. But still, Carr, supplemented, I think, by the kinds of insights into nationalism that later scholars like Gellner introduced, and taking into account novel features of period five, for example, non-state terrorism, which was something that Carr never had to address, interactive social media, which he never had to address, post-industrial economic development, which he never had to address. So a lot of extra complications. But if we brought with it Carr's spirit of practical engagement and his focus on the issue of a multipolar state sovereign system, nationalism and economic inequality, I think we do have, can get some inspiration from him from practical ways of trying to understand and cope with our present very large difficulties. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sean. We'll go straight on to Mary. I know you're a great fan of Ernest Gellner as well as E.H. Carr, but over to you, Mary. Can you speak, Mary? Can you unmute?
Gifted.
Right.
My laptop was unstable and I shifted to my iPad and I was using my... Anyway. Yes, I mean, Ernest Gellner, I knew Ernest Gellner, and actually at the very beginning of the war in Yugoslavia, I organised a meeting in Belgrade with the aim of ending the war. And Ernest came from Prague by bus. He thought it was so important and gave a passionate speech against national self-determination. So I'm very influenced by Gellner, but it was also, I have to say, that I am very sympathetic to E.H. Carr. And that I'm really going to talk about Carr, although I will try and bring in Gellner. I think the real significance of this book that Nick has very usefully republished is the kind of international relations, the kind of world order that he proposes. And what does it involve? It involves, as he puts it, a balanced structure of multinational and international groupings. He doesn't quite say what they are. It involves functional organizations. Very importantly, it involves human rights. He says we can only have freedom and equality of the individual, not of the nation. And this has to be recognized in any international system. He sees the problem that the international system was defined in terms of the freedom and equality of nations as the big problem. And finally, he thinks it has to have a common project, and that common project has to be social justice. And so I suppose what I thought I would do today was to think about what this means for the current era. Because on the one hand, we are seeing the reemergence of nationalism, the rise of authoritarianism and populism. But on the other hand, I think the COVID pandemic, the beginnings of climate change, actually means that this is could be a big moment of transformation. It's a moment when we actually need to have much greater global cooperation. So we have these contradictory elements, and that's what I thought I would talk about, although I'm afraid I'm going to talk mostly about the negative things and come back to the positive things, or possibly positive, at the end. So I think if we talk about the current phase of nationalism, like John, I think I'd call it the fourth. In a way, each of Carr's periods was associated with what one might call a type of nationalism. And I think what we're seeing with the rise of authoritarian populism is what we might call, if we're using Carr's typology, as the fourth type of nationalism. So the first period, as John said, I think both John and Gellner are right, wasn't really about nationalism. It was about sovereigns. It was about the rise of states that were personified in the monarch, in the sovereign. And it was a period where international relations were characterized by a kind of gentlemanly discourse among the sovereigns who were all related and who spoke French. And they had mercantilist wars to capture markets. And they respected, they were fairly limited and gentlemanly. I don't know how gentlemanly. And they respected neutrals and they respected non-combatants. The second period, I guess, is the period which Carr calls national irredentism. John talked about this. But I think he's really talking about what he sees as a fairly progressive kind of nationalism. It is the end of absolutism. It's the period when people wanted to construct nations as a vehicle for democracy and for development. If you wanted to have democracy, who were the people, and the people were the nation? I think although it was, and of course, what Carr says is this was very much linked to the middle classes. It was bourgeois nationalism. And the corollary of that, of course, is that although most people regard that type of nationalism as relatively progressive, it was, of course, both exclusivist and violent. It was exclusivist in that it excluded women. In America, it excluded Blacks, it excluded Native Americans. Today, we'd have called it apartheid. In Britain, it excluded the poor. So it was a sort of elite type of nationalism, as Carr says. And it was also associated with wars for territory, but even more importantly, it was associated with empire. Gosh, I've made it so dark, I can hardly see what I'm saying. Gellner, I think the other aspect was, of course, that it was culturally exclusive. And John has described Gellner's argument, that, which I agree with, that nations are the product of industry, that what you got was the emergence of what he called a vertical high culture, a literate culture based on the vernacular, so that people could communicate with each other in the same idiom. And of course, this was a culture that eradicated, it was forcibly assimilationist, and it eradicated many other languages and dialects. I think also what's very important is that it wasn't just industry, it was also, as Anderson tells us, it was print technology. It was the fact that you could print in the vernacular. And Anderson tells us that it was novels and newspapers in the vernacular that enabled people to imagine themselves as a nation. I think most importantly is the link to war. I think even this early, nationalism was really rather militaristic. I've followed some of the peace congresses of the mid-19th century where all the nationalists came, but some of the peace activists were really furious about the inclusion of Garibaldi, who they regarded as a militarist. But I think what was important about war is that war is what gave nationalism its ability to arouse passion. It's interesting, I mean, to talk about Gellner again, Gellner says that Marxism was only the dominant ideology in the Soviet Union as long as there was violence. Violence gave Marxism a sort of sanctity. The doctrine of Marxism was a kind of religion as long as there was violence. Once the violence stopped, it became banal. And I think that's also true of nationalism, that nationalism was constructed, it was spread in wars. That was when the idea of the nation really took hold. So then finally, there is the third period that John's also talked about, at what Carr sees as the totalitarian socialized nationalism of the 20th century. And as John said, it's the consequence of the involvement of the whole population. Again, I wonder if this is nationalism actually, because it was associated with the rise of empires and of blocs. It was also associated with utopian ideas like fascism, communism, and I would add imperialism. So if this is roughly what his three, and of course it was associated very much with the world, wars, the whole totalitarian conception was a wartime conception. It was a notion of permanent war, as Orwell vividly describes in 1984. So what is 21st century nationalism? Is that, I mean, John was saying it was a fifth period. I think I'll call it a fourth period. How does this relate to the earlier periods of nationalism? Well, I think it's much more divisive and fragmented than earlier nationalism. Although, of course, it has antecedents in the breakup of the Austro-Hungarian and the Ottoman empires, as John described, which were quite similar. But whereas 19th century nationalism, and indeed you could argue post-colonial nationalism in much of the South, global South, were very much about defining a people for the purposes of democracy and development, and also in the European case, 19th century European case, for external expansion. I think the new nationalism is much more about access to the state on behalf of particular groups, whether these groups are ethnically defined, religiously defined, or racially defined. So it's about disintegration of the state, state unbuilding, rather than about state building. I mean, take the Brexit movement as an example. For all Boris's talk of global Britain, the Brexit movement is really, the project is really white English nationalism. It's hugely divisive domestically, and it's likely to lead to the breakup of Britain. It's going to lead to Scottish independence and perhaps the return of violence in Northern Ireland. So if we say that this new nationalism is much more about domestic division than it is about, I don't know, big external expansion, what has brought it about? Well, I think one factor which Carr emphasized and which I agree with is that I do think the nationalism comes in waves, and these waves and the emergence of destructive forms of nationalism is very much associated, as Mick said in his introduction, is associated with social and economic crisis. It was laissez-faire doctrines that really produced the nationalism of the 20th century. And I think you can equally argue that that this new nationalism is the outcome of four decades of neoliberalism. The other issue is that I do think the new nationalism is also associated with war, but again, a different kind of war, not the big totalizing wars that the third period was associated with, but what I call new wars, or what the Russians call non-linear wars. These are wars that are disintegrative. They involve the disassembly of the state. They're wars that are fragmented. They're wars that are also transnational. And they're wars that are protracted. Now, one other factor that I want to bring in about the nature of the new type of nationalism, and this relates to Gellner. So Gellner said, as we've already talked about, that the culture, that the new, the 19th and 20th century nationalism was very much linked to industrialization. I think the new nationalism has to be understood as linked to post-industrialization. I think it's linked, I think today industry has increasingly been supplanted in the global economy by finance and services. And whereas industry is very much linked to territory, it's physically located. Finance and services are both very global and very localized. And that has to be combined with the rise of digital communications replacing print technology, which allows for the spread of new horizontal, transnational, virtual communities. So on the one hand, of course, it does give rise to, if you like, cosmopolitan communities, the communities of what Gelmer called the consumerist unbelievers, the communities that are very much associated with the spread of the global market, the people who meet at Davos. It also has given rise to a global human rights community with all the big international NGOs and the raising of issues from Hong Kong to Xinjiang and Ukraine or whatever, Yemen, Syria. But it's also given rise to what we might call nationalist virtual communities, Islamism, fundamentalist Christians, all of these new authoritarian populists, Bolsonaro, Trump, Orban, are part of a sort of transnational populist authoritarianism. So all of that creates a very new kind of nationalism that's associated with new types of wars. It's that are very, very difficult to end, and that's very destructive. And so my feeling is that if we can't come to terms with this and try to find ways to counter it, we could see a very depressing long-term future in which the kinds of wars that never seem to end in places like Syria, Yemen, the kinds of things I study could spread. So, given this really depressing context, what are the prospects for the kind of international order envisaged by E.H. Carr? Well, I want to first of all draw attention to two developments that relate to Carr's original ideas. First of all, the sort of functionalism envisaged by Carr has hugely increased. We're all now deeply connected to a very thick global regulatory framework. We have more and more rules relating to trade, relating to investment, relating to money, relating to the environment, and we have more and more organizations designed to guarantee those rules. The European Union actually, as I think it was Mick who pointed it out, is actually the epitome of this. The Monnet method was all about taking a lead on functionalism, encouraging economic and social integration in the hopes that politics would follow. And as we know from the Brexit experience, it's really, really difficult to disentangle yourself from these mass of rules globally, the administered space of the entire world. And so that in itself, I think, is a sort of safeguard, but of course it can be disentangled by this destructive nationalism as it is in conflict zones. And so it needs a kind of accompanying politics. The other development, which I think is really important, is the development of human rights, which is something that Carr was really calling for, but didn't really exist in 1945. There was the Declaration on Human Rights, but then you got conventions in the 1950s. But what was really important was the rise of a human rights movement, Helsinki movement, Human Rights Watch, the human rights groups in Latin America, that really pushed for human rights so that by the 90s, human rights had become a really important factor in world order and the way you think about world order. Of course, that is going away now. I mean, it's being reversed, but it's still there. And I think what also is very important, and this is linked to digitalization, is the sense of global consciousness, the sense that we live in a single, quite small planet, and it's all we have, that events that have taken place historically, like the Holocaust, like Hiroshima, as Robertson says, are global events. They're enshrined in global memory. And we do have global movements. I mean, we have Black Lives Matter, we have Extinction Rebellion, we have the social forums. So these are all counter trends that exist to the rise of authoritarian populism. So, you know, the question really arises then, could this COVID moment make some of this come true? I mean, what we do know is that we're never going to be able to eliminate the pandemic unless we act globally, unless we vaccinate everybody. In conflict zones, for example, COVID is transmitted very rapidly because there's hardly any healthcare facilities and because there are crowded places like refugee camps and prisons where COVID transmits very fast. And until you can create some peace and vaccinate those areas, there's always going to be the risk of a vaccine-resistant variant developing there. So actually, you know, we've started talking about it. There was a brief moment when it looked like we might give up patents on vaccines. There's been COVAX, but it's much too little, not nearly enough is being done. And it requires a much greater degree of global cooperation. And of course, the same is true of climate change. And we are seeing immediate effects of climate change and floods and forest fires and all the things that are getting worse in a quite frightening way. So the question is this COVID moment, which is a kind of crisis moment, and it's a crisis moment when we're not thinking about soldiers, we're thinking about healthcare workers, is this sufficient to bring about the kind of changes that Carr envisaged? And the only thing I would add to Carr's model is I agree about, you know, it being composed of multinational groupings, and I think regional groupings, I think the European Union could be a kind of model which involves not actually, I think, a new empire, but something that involves the pooling of sovereignty of nation states, that something that deals with the worst aspects of nation state, domestic repression and war, and yet at the same time enables them to exist. But I think it's just got to be both global and local, because the complexity of the current world means that it has to be dealt with at local levels as well as global levels. And I think if I have one criticism of Carr, it is what Mick called his largism. I think small is good too, and you need a combination. But I think the jury is out as to whether we can get there. And if not, I think we face a very grim future.
Thank you very much, Mary. Right, well, that's a very, very broad agenda. We only unfortunately have 15 minutes left. And I'm just going to, because the question's very interesting and they fall into five points that have been made. One refers, Mick, to your point about E.H. Carr being left-wing. Is there such thing as a right-wing criticism of nationalism? And was there a right-wing criticism of nationalism at the time? One applies to the whole point about the Eurocentric nature of this discussion, although Mary, of course, touched upon Yemen and Syria and other points. But what's the landscape in the Middle East? Because we did have pan-Arabism in the 50s that didn't go anywhere, rather like pan-Africanism at the same period, perhaps later in the 60s. So nation states are with us, but how genuine are they in terms of what would be recognized as nation states? third point on big, is big beautiful or is big not beautiful? The idea is that the question is that multilateralism is based on small states, not big states. And one of the criticisms of the European Union might be it's too big and that it's actually firing up nationalism. Brexit might just be the first of many challenges. Another, which John referred to on political economy, does nationalism amplify social hierarchies and economic inequalities? But as someone also sent in a question, but surely the welfare state was based on a national idea and originally on nationalism. A point made, I think, by Matthew D'Ancona in his point in his book on identity, which is critical of liberals for proposing that politics should be based on group identity rather than national shared values and conceptions of what would be in the national common good. But then the question is, to what extent does this national identity end up with nationalism or lends itself to exploitation by extreme nationalism? And a last question, which I think would be addressed to you, Mick, since you're a fan of football and England versus Germany is taking place as we speak, what would E.H. Carr actually have to say about sport and nationalism? So we have all these questions and we have less than 10 minutes to address them. Would any of you like to address one of those questions, starting with you, Mick?
Sorry to interrupt, Christopher. Thank you. Firstly, thank you both to John and to Mary for your very thoughtful comments, by the way, and that was great. So thank you very much indeed. We could discuss one or two points on the slide, but we don't need to. Let's get on to some of those questions. They're good. Christopher poses the question very nicely. Can there be a right-wing critique of nationalism? Well, I think there can be. It's called imperialism. I mean, most imperialists, let me take Winston Churchill. I don't think he was a great fan of Indian nationalism. Most imperialists actually didn't like nationalism very, very much, unless it was their own nationalism, which they then said it wasn't nationalism, it was civilization. So I think there is a right-wing critique. It basically comes out of an imperialist mentality itself. But of course, Carr, although I think there was something imperial about Carr, I mean, he often worked in the Foreign Office for the better part of 20 years for the British Empire. Let's not get away from that. Nonetheless, I think what was quite extraordinary about Carr is how within the framework of working within the British establishment, nonetheless, he did develop a kind of what I would call a left-wing critique of the economic order and of the political order. It was really quite remarkable, an insider-outsider approach, which was really... It's not entirely never been known before that insiders can become critical of the system, but he was a very interesting example of that. He was a great admirer of Keynes, by the way, on the Versailles Peace Treaty, which was also mentioned. And I think he drew quite a lot of critique of the Versailles Peace Treaty and his view on nationalism from Keynes as well, who was a liberal, after all, quintessential liberal. And Keynes's argument against the Versailles Peace Treaty, putting aside the whole question of German reparations, was that if you break down Central Eastern Europe into small fragments, you're not going to get an economic recovery. You're not going to get economic rehabilitation. And you're not going to get a viable economic order within Central and Eastern Europe, which gets to the point that John made about Versailles. In a sense, the tragedy of Versailles in some ways, John, I think, I don't think it was going to be any different to what finally happened. I mean, in a sense, you're watching a slow-moving train wreck coming towards you as you kind of watch the Versailles Peace Treaty unfold. There was no way that one could find any alternative to the collapse of the old Austro-Hungarian Empire, etc., without self-determination and without the creation of small states or smallish states, which themselves then went into wars against one another and never completely resolved their own minorities question, and indeed could not essentially become economically viable. But thanks for the question of being right. Yes, the imperialists are kind of right-wing critics. You know, there is a large literature out there, Christopher, a more conservative character, which is highly anti-nationalist and believes that empires were good and empires shouldn't be too critical of them. On the sport question, very, very quickly, well, I'm glad you said that, because the football game started about 10 minutes ago, I know, and that's probably why quite a lot of people have gone off. I'm not quite sure what Carr would say on sport, but let me just, however, draw in somebody else who Carr did know something about. Philip Noel Baker was the first professor of international relations, as you know, Christopher. This is not answering the question, but I'm answering the question I really want to be asked. Philip Noel Baker was the first professor of international relations at the LSE, and he was an Olympian. He was a great Olympian. He actually won a silver medal, the only one at the LSE ever to win one, I think, in the Olympics ever. And then went on to win the Nobel Peace Prize in 1959. But he was a huge supporter of the Olympics movement. Now, I know that's not the same thing as the form of football we're watching at the moment across Europe. But he actually believed that sport, international sport, through the Olympics movement, could actually bring people together. And he always held to that principle. Now, you could say that he was a naive liberal, and possibly he was, but sport does not always have to divide. Sport does not always have to divide, as I think some people say now. On nationalism, quickly, on political economy, yeah. Carr does have a political economy. He basically thinks the way the world economy is moving and should move in the future actually makes the nation state as the seat of economic activity less and less important. You could almost say he's a kind of an early theorist of globalization. The globalization, the growth of interconnectivity in the 19th century, we call free trade, that the nation state, in a sense, becomes a blockage and an obstacle to the development of what he would believe would be a viable international division of labor. And what you needed to do was to bring political space or the political unit into conformity with the growing economic trends of the 20th century. I'll finish there, by the way.
Thank you very much. John, just if you can address one question out of that set.
Difficult. Just very briefly on the conservative critique, it was interesting that one of the people that Carr got on very well with at Versailles, I learned this from Mick's introduction, was Louis Namier. Louis Namier also detested Polish nationalism, but he detested Polish nationalism not as a British middle-class liberal, he detested it as a Polish Jew. He, in other words, and he went on to actually extol his work as a British historian, extol the British conservative establishment rooted in the land, rooted in hierarchy, and so on. And another great conservative figure was the Ilo Kaduri, who in many ways wrote one of the first pioneering modern studies of nationalism, but also wrote something called On the Chatham House Version, which actually is, in a sense, was praising the British Empire, a man who had lived as a subordinate, a subject within it, finding something to praise and being concerned about the anarchy that would follow. I would say that the way in which the nation state was generalized to the world was very different. I mean, I suppose the historian I'm particularizing, the post-45 legitimation of states was not the ethno-linguistic legitimation post-Versailles. It was basically people, in many ways, diplomats were reacting against Versailles, and they were saying, order is absolutely essential. Let's go with the units that the imperial governments themselves had established. And it is amazing, if you look at a map of Africa, the borders are pretty much the borders of the colonial units, to some extent modified. That in a way, you know, this ensures political continuity and we try to fit new elites in. The other thing I just wanted to say was about how you can get a moderation of the nation-state unit. It seems to me that nationalism today, Mary made the point, is divisive. It's mainly reactive. It's not offering positive solutions. It isn't offering the solutions of unification or the post-imperial settlement of Europe. It's simply reacting against bigger things it doesn't like. The question is, why? How can those bigger things prevail? And it seems to me one is obviously formal alliances of states, like NATO once existed, or the Warsaw Pact. Second are functional groupings. In other words, you get postal unions or monetary unions. If only we could have a vaccine union that really worked. A third is something that's often denounced on the left, but it's just informal regional power. Alan Millward once made the interesting point that Hitler didn't need to go to war to dominate Czechoslovakia and Poland and the like. Already through economic agreements, the resurgent German economy was dominating these places, and a nationalist would be appalled because by going for racial expansion, he's actually undermining the very nation state the German nationalists supported. So again, informal links, the way China might basically shape informally its neighbours, the way the USA shapes, often badly, its South American neighbours. And then finally, of course, there is this problem about time zone, time constraints. What are a short-term interest versus a long-term interest? The problem that Mary draws to attention to, vaccine, climate change. In the short term, there are strong reasons to do nothing. In the long term, this is absolutely fatal. What needs to be pressed, I think, is the case for making that long term through functional units, through formal alliances, and through regional spheres of influence, to make that longer term perspective take priority over the short term perspective.
Thanks very much. Mary, you have 4 minutes.
Okay, well, let me just very briefly answer two questions. I mean, one is the sports question. I agree with Nick that in general, sports are good, and I agree with Philip Noel Baker. And the Olympics were originally invented by the Greeks as a way of bringing people together. It was meant originally as a peace project. Nevertheless, in all the conflicts I study, football has often played a very problematic role. One of the worst militias in Bosnia was composed of the fan club of the Belgrade Football Club. So I think we need to positively think about how to make sports, ensure that sports are a contribution to peace rather than a cause of division. The other issue I wanted to answer was the post-colonial question. I mean, I did mention very briefly that I thought post-colonial nationalism was quite similar to mid-19th century nationalism, in that it was a way of mobilizing people against colonialism. It was seen as a vehicle for creating a democracy and for promoting development. I think, of course, the problem was, like 19th century nationalism, was that it excluded women. It was very paternalistic. The first sort of generation of leaders, with the exception of India, tended to be very authoritarian. And also, I think, it did contribute to ethnic problems, in part by retaining the British division between subject and citizen that Mamdani talks about, retaining what were seen as customary laws, which had actually been ways in which the British imposed rule on remote parts of the countryside. So for all those reasons, it laid the seeds of a new kind of nationalism, which we're seeing now. But I think it's a really good question, and it's something really important to develop. I finally have a question that no one will have time to answer. I'm not a historian, but my question to Nick and John, which they won't be able to answer, but perhaps another time, is why couldn't you have just had the democratization of the Austro-Hungarian Empire and the Ottoman Empire? I know a lot of my friends in post-Soviet states said they didn't want nationalism, they didn't want nation state, they wanted to democratize the Soviet Union. And actually, if you'd kept those empires loosely together under a different framework of rule, that we wouldn't have so many of the problems that we have today. You know, we need actually something like the European Union in the Middle East, and you know, maybe the European Union is bit by bit solving some of the problems of Eastern Europe, although we have the huge problems of Poland and Hungary at the moment. But that's a big question, historical question in my mind.
That's a wonderful what if question. what if the Austro-Hungarian Empire and the Ottoman Empire had survived? And I'm sure we could take an hour and a half answering that question. I'm very sorry that I have to bring it to an end. We've had a very rich, intellectually rich discussion, because it's been very diverse. It's been very broad, and three different perspectives, really, on nationalism through the focus of E.H. Carr. The questions are still coming in, by the way, so I do apologize for those participants who wanted to raise them and we weren't able to deal with them. And now I'm afraid we have to allow people to go off and watch the Germany-England match and cheer for their respective sides, hopefully in an Olympic spirit rather than the spirit of nationalism. But I have a feeling that the spirit of nationalism will raise its head in the next hour or so on the football field and the terraces. Thank you all very, very much, and hope you'll come back to one of our other events in the future. Bye for now.
Thank you very much, Christopher. Thank you, John, and thank you, Mary, and thanks to all the questions.